This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
To say that we live in extraordinary times would probably not be an overstatement. As a matter of fact, it might be an understatement. The question is whether you consider that a blessing or a curse. Some have labeled it to be the new normal. Well, whatever you want to call it, it's what it is, and we've never experienced anything like it in our lifetimes, but nevertheless, we have to negotiate it.
You know, John, I've seen probably both extremes in my career spanning over three decades. I mean, you know, I think back at where we are today and I look back when I got in the business late 79, 1980. I mean, if we take a look at what was that going on then, we had $40 oil, double digit inflation, gold was at 800, and more importantly, interest rates were at 15.5%. I still remember to this day, the very first investment I ever did for a client was a 10-year treasury note at 15%. How many of us would love to have that today? But interest rates were so high that probably in the first decade, at least when I was in the business, most of everything we did was fixed income, because who wanted to be in the stock market when you got 12, 13% at the bank? Heck, I was getting 14% on Ginnie Mae's, 15% on treasuries, 9, 10% on tax-free bonds. Who wanted to take the risk of going into the stock market? There was no reason to invest in stocks when you were getting double-digit returns, and those returns were real. In other words, the interest rate paid was well above the inflation rate. So here we are now, three decades later, with the lowest interest rates that we've seen in centuries. And I think the word extraordinary doesn't even begin to describe what we're seeing today.
Yeah, for a long time, people scoffed at Japan. I mean, they brought rates down to 0.5%, and the world viewed it as if it were an anomaly. But, well, here we are now in the United States, where they're basically at zero. It's a similar situation. We've been here for 6 years already. This is a significant point, and it doesn't look like high rates are going to be around anytime soon in the near future.
You know, the one thing that we're seeing now, John, that I think explains a lot of this, is we're seeing global liquidity really in terms of what is really unprecedented. We've never seen anything like it. In the past, you might have had maybe the Fed usually initiating low interest rates and easy money, but at other times, other central banks were tightening, very much like what we saw coming out of the 2009 bottom. The Fed launched QE1. Well, we had Europe raising interest rates in 2011. So the rest of the world was raising interest rates while we were lowering them. Now, if you take a look at where we're at now, we're not just at decade lows in interest rates. We're talking about century lows. Let me put this into perspective. I mean, if we take a look at where Treasury yields are today, we're at a 220-year low in interest rates. In fact, in July of 2012, which some technicians would say is marked the bottom in interest rates, when we got down to 1.45%, you would almost have to go back to the founding of this country several centuries ago to find interest rates this low. And if you think about it, at the end of 2014, a three-month treasury bill offered an interest rates of 0.04%. And if you think about it, rates have been essentially at zero since November of 2008. The last time, John, we witnessed anything coming close to this would have been the Great Depression.
Yeah, this has to have impacted so many segments of the economy. And the real question is, compared to what happened, say, in the 1980s and 1990s, how do investors save for retirement when interest rates are at 0%? Banks pay nothing on deposits. I always like it when I get a bank statement and it said, "We paid you 9 cents." And I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to.
And you turn to Carol and you go, "Let's go out to dinner."
Yeah, right. I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to feel a chill down my spine or something like that, but you know, that's pretty much what it is. Zero interest rates are forcing people to take risks, even in bonds. You know, if you people keeping their money there, they don't realize how much they're losing in terms of real buying power in dollars.
I mean, we really truly are at a special time in history. I mean, Interest rates are at historic lows, and that's putting it lightly. I want to put this in perspective for a lot of our listeners in terms of historical precedent. That one of the first central banks to merge in the developed world was the Bank of England. It was founded in 1694. To put this into perspective, John, in the 300-year history of the Bank of England, the Bank of England's base rate has never been lower than 0.5%, except for since the financial crisis, where it's been at 0.5% for 6 years. Think about that. The bank was founded in 1694, and this is the lowest interest rate that the Bank of England has offered in its entire history. And when you think about it, it's not just the lowest interest rate in over 300 years. We're really living in historical times, as we've never seen stimulus in terms of monetary stimulus on a global basis as to what we're seeing today is really unprecedented. And it's the first time in the history of the world we've seen anything like this. So to say extraordinary, that is a light adjective to put on what we're actually doing or what central banks are doing today.
Yeah, and you realize that for the first time in the history of the world, too, basically all the currencies of the world are inflationary, at least all the major ones. And this is probably what makes this stand out. It's a global event or phenomenon, I guess. It's not really a single event. In the last decade, the U.S. was mainly the country with low rates. You could get higher rates overseas, for example, but now the rates there are lower in the rest of the world than in the U.S. And who would have ever thought that a global crisis which originated in the U.S. would actually come out this way, because we now have the best house, as you say, in a somewhat shabby global neighborhood.
You know, it truly is global. I mean, if you look at today, it's not just in the past, if the U.S. was lowering interest rates, you could probably always count on, as a result of diversification, you could probably find higher interest rates in Europe or in Asia. But if you look at today, German interest rates today are 0.3% for a 10-year treasury note. And to put that in perspective, John, that's the lowest interest rate we've seen in Germany in over 200 years. If you look at France, we're back to interest rates last seen since probably the mid-1700s. French bond yields are 0.6% for a 10-year treasury note. That's the lowest they've been in nearly two centuries. Embrace yourself for the next one. If we take a look at Dutch bond yields, they're roughly under 0.4%. That's the lowest Dutch bond yields in 500 years. So rates are really at historic lows globally. And John, it's everywhere. It's not just in the U.S. It's in Europe. It's in Asia. It's in South America. Despite the increase in debt, and since the financial crisis, global debt has increased by $28 trillion, and most of that has been on the sovereign side. So debt levels have increased, and yet we are looking at the lowest interest rate in centuries.
Well, what are the implications then of these low rates? Let's face it, if things go in somewhat cyclical fashion, they can't remain there forever. At some point, they're going to rise. And when they do, investors are going to lose a lot of money. We got a glimpse of that, by the way, in 2013 with the taper tantrum when bond yields doubled. And at that time, the people who were bond fund investors lost high single to double digit losses. And the real question is, do you think this is going to happen again?
Yeah, I do. I think it is happening, and you're already seeing it on the short end. I mean, if you take a look at Japanese bond yields, they were 19 basis points less than probably a month ago. Today, they're at 32 basis points. And if we take a look at what's happening on the short end, it's starting to happen. Because when you have rates that are zero bound like they are today, the only way up is really going up. I mean, once you hit bottom, there's no other place to go but up. The question, I guess, remains is on timing, because right now central banks are fighting deflation. But we know from the Great Depression, John, when you can't fix deflation, there's an easy way to do it. It was done with FDR overnight when he devalued the dollar by almost 40-50%. And right now, We're seeing a tremendous amount of excess foreign debt. It's become a global phenomenon. And we've seen really since the financial crisis, everybody's talking about deleveraging, but we really haven't done so. Maybe we've done a little bit at the consumer level and we've done it in the private sector, but there's been very minimal deleveraging overall when you take a look at debt levels have actually increased. And what happens when you get sovereign debt levels that tend to increase like this, historically, as we've gotten from reading Reinhardt and Rogoff, is you look for increasing default risk. And when default risk starts to rise, and you're seeing the possibility of that from a number of countries, from Greece to the Ukraine to Venezuela to Nigeria to Russia and Brazil. Remember, it wasn't long ago, it was, 17 years ago, that Russia defaulted on its debt, and you take a look at their currency debasement, which has been about 50% right now. They're in a recession. They've got falling revenues, and they're at risk of defaulting again. And when you have countries, when they start to begin to default, what we know historically is that when that happens, you see the rise of inflation. And right now, you've got a real risk of that happening in the emerging market, especially with these dollar-denominated loans. As the dollar increases and the Fed raises interest rates, these borrowers are hit from two sources. They're not only going to pay a higher interest rate, but they're going to have to pay back those loans in depreciated currencies, which means it's going to actually cost them a lot more. So there's a real risk right now for a lot of investors that are in these emerging market bond funds. I don't think they have a realization of what they can lose, not only on rising interest rates, but also on falling currencies, so they can get hit with a double whammy. Last time this happened was back in 1994, when Greenspan doubled the federal funds rate in a single year. I can remember a lot of these emerging bond funds lost 20, 30, as much as 40%. And we know when that happens, when you see a history of defaults begin, it's not too much longer when you start to see the rise of inflation. I mean, think of Russia in 1998, or think of Argentina at the beginning of the last decade.
Yeah, you also have to think of the sociological chaos that tends to result from that. It's not a topic for this show, but there's often involved in politics rather radical changeovers as well. But right now we have a divergence. The U.S. is closer to tightening. You know, if you listen to this week's testimony by Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen, the rest of the world is moving toward loosening, by the way. And just looking over the horizon, it does seem like we have some kind of a storm brewing.
You know, I think we're in the midst of what Jim Rickards calls a currency war. We're seeing countries pursue policies that weaken their currency. They're looking for ways to improve their economy, and the rest of the world is more export-driven and less self-sufficient as the U.S. economy is. I think the U.S. has, I think, exports only account for about 13% of our GDP. So we're less export-driven. A lot of these countries like Europe or China or Japan are more export-driven. So one of the ways they try to grow their economy or get themselves out of an economic mess is debase their currency or pursue policies that depreciate it. So it's very similar to the beggar thy neighbor policies that we saw in the 1930s. So now you have a Federal Reserve that has moved from ending tapering, which is what they did last year, and they're now moving towards raising interest rates. At the time, the rest of the world is moving towards lowering interest rates. So, John, anytime you have divergences in major, monetary policies like that, these are the kind of things that lead to some kind of financial turmoil, which is more than likely.
Yes, true. Okay, the goal that investors have is generating money. That's the goal of investing. But given these historically low interest rates, you have to both try to earn money and at the same time protect yourself from the ravages of whatever storms might be coming. How do you do that?
You know, the same advice we've been given on this program over the last couple of years. I mean, if you're going to be in bonds, you know, you want to be in short maturities and you want to have a laddered bond portfolio. So if you invest $10,000 in a bond and matures in 4 or 5 years, you know you're going to get your $10,000 back. You know, that's not what you're going to get in a bond fund because bond funds have no maturities. And I mean, you almost have to be crazy to be buying bonds right now in some of these places like Europe where, you know, I'm just looking at a Bloomberg screen. If you're buying Swiss government bonds, you're actually paying money to the Swiss government, meaning that you're guaranteed to lose money. And do you really want to lock up for 10 years interest rates at, you know, 0.3%, 0.2%, 0.6%? I think that's just absolutely insane. Same thing in Japan right now, where bond yields are down to 0.3% when they're debasing their currency at double digits a year. So I think that if you're in a bond fund right now, you know, I think you're just asking to lose money. And especially if you're in long dated treasuries, if you're going out on the yield curve in a bond fund searching for yield. So unless, you know, maybe you're skilled in technical analysis and you plan to trade them, you know, I just don't see a compelling issue to lock in interest rates at this low unless you think the world's going to end and everything's going to crash. But remember, the greatest source of debt buildup is not in the private sector, it's in the public sector, and that's where the crisis will originate when it finally arrives. And in many of these cases, it's not just that you're, let's say, loaning money to sovereign banks at some of the lowest interest rates in 200, 500 years, depending on what you're buying. In many cases, you have 10 to 15% of the world's bonds that are actually going to charge you interest for them to borrow money from you, meaning that you're getting a negative rate of return. And eventually, I think you're going to see, just as we saw in the late 90s in Asia and also in Russia, you're going to start to see defaults. You're going to see a lot more countries start to debase their currency as one way to get out of it. And ultimately, that's going to lead to higher inflation. So it's one reason, John, I think you have to have some gold and silver, as Frank Holmes talked about in hour one. You want to have some of that in your portfolio. But as Frank mentioned, and here's a guy that manages gold. He has a gold fund. He advocates you don't want to put more than 10%. It's there for insurance and for a reason. And this is one reason to have it. But you may have to be a little bit on the patient's side on this one. But you need to have some bullion insurance in your portfolio, because we are going to see currency debasement. And that's going to become more prominent as we go forward in the future.
Well, to repeat what I have said before, it's a resume. Truly historical times in which we find ourselves right now. Eventually, there has to be a crisis at the end of this. But as long as the central banks are flooding their markets and the rates remain low, everything will keep puttering along until there are defaults, and then come devaluations and following inflation. So stay tuned. We're going to start chronicling the approaching distant storm, just like you would for an oncoming hurricane, telling people how and when to get prepared right here on Financial Sense.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The two great financial crises of the past century are the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Great Recession, which began in 2008. Both occurred against the backdrop of sharp credit booms, dubious banking practices, and a fragile and unstable global financial system. When markets went into cardiac arrest in 2008, policymakers invoked the lessons of the Great Depression in attempting to avert the worst. While their response prevented a financial collapse and catastrophic depression like that of the 1930s, unemployment in the U.S. and Europe still rose to excruciating high levels. Pain and suffering were widespread. The question given this is, why didn't policymakers do better? Joining me on the program is author Barry Eichengreen. He's author of a new book called Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. Professor, your book is about financial crises, the events that bring them about, and why governments and markets respond as they do. Two of the major crises,
in the last 100 years, as you talk about, are the Great Depression and Great Recession. In your mind, what are the parallels that you see between these two great crises, and what made them similar, what made them different?
Well, I think the run-up to the two crises had a lot in common. The crisis of the 1920s was fueled by reckless financial deregulation, monetary policy that was too loose for too long, and what, using modern terminology, we would call global imbalances, large capital flows to one half of Europe from the other half of Europe and the rest of the world. I've just described to you the 1920s, but I think very much the same set of circumstances what was in place to set the stage for our Great Recession. Policymakers then responded better this time than they had in the 1930s. As you said in your intro, Jim, unemployment in the U.S. exceeded 10% at its worst in 2009, but it exceeded 24% in 1933. So we did better. I think on balance, the Fed's response to the Great Recession and the response of Congress and the administration to the Great Recession was a whole lot better than what was done in the Hoover years of the 1930s. But success was the mother of failure, I think, because we headed off complete financial collapse. We have not done enough to strengthen the financial system subsequently.
Economic conditions may, for some time, warrant keeping the federal funds rate below levels the committee views as normal in the longer run. It's possible, for example, that it may be necessary for the federal funds rate to run temporarily below its normal longer-run level because the residual effects of the financial crisis may continue to weigh on economic activity. As such factors continue to dissipate, we would expect the federal funds rate to move toward its longer-run normal level. In response to unforeseen developments, the committee will adjust the target range for the federal funds rate to best promote the achievement of maximum employment and 2% inflation.
Well, I'm sure you recognize the voice of Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen up on Capitol Hill this week. The markets like what she had to say. Stocks are moving into record territory, giving a little of that back on Friday. So let's delve into the Oracle's pronouncements, Jim, and where we think this is leading us.
You know, one of the first things that really struck me about her testimony is the Fed chair gave some very upbeat assessment on the economy. Now, maybe they're seeing some things here that may be turning around here as they go forward. But, John, how many times have we seen the Fed come out, make statements in terms of their policy, what they thought was going to happen in the economy, only to reverse themselves? Think of 2010, 11, and 12. So, you know, given the readings we got on this Friday, we got the second reading on fourth quarter GDP. Instead of 2.6%, it came in at 2.2. Now, that beat expectations. But nonetheless, we've gone back from the 5% or 4% growth rates that we saw in the second quarter and third quarter of last year. Now we're back down to 2.2%, very similar to what we saw last year. So this is the year that economists are saying that the economy is finally going to hit that 3% growth rate. Well, if you're already starting out at 2.2% in the fourth quarter, and there's nothing that we've seen in the economic numbers here in Q1, they would indicate we're going through a barn burner. That means that maybe second quarter, third quarter, or fourth quarter are really going to have to accelerate to get that 3% number. So we're already down to 2.2%. And another factor is it just seems incongruous with what we're hearing from manufacturers. For example, industrial producers are scaling back on their expansion plans. Manufacturing is only going to raise capacity at less than 2% this year. It's actually about 1.8% for 2015. That's the smallest increase, John, that we've seen since 2011 after boosting capacity by 3.1% last year. So whether we're seeing banks sit on a lot of money, whether we're seeing manufacturers pulling back on increasing capacity, whether we're seeing companies cut back on capital expenditures, or we're seeing a slowdown in housing, there's a lot of things that are going on in the economy right now that are pointing to a slowdown. We're still going to see economic growth this year, but are we going to see it at an accelerating pace strong enough to warrant raising interest rates as soon as June, as many economists are predicting? The economic numbers don't justify that. In fact, the manufacturing sector, housing sector, and the rest of the economy has a different assessment of where the economy is going forward than, let's say, the Fed's upbeat assessment.
And what we're seeing right now is the global economy is slowing down. The U.S. is slowing down. But I have a question. Why the emphasis on preparing for rate hikes? Why do you think this is so poignant for what we're discussing?
You know, I think the Fed is preparing, but they're proceeding with caution, John. And they know eventually they're going to have to raise interest rates because they don't want to get into another crisis and not have any bullets in the chamber. More importantly, if you leave interest rates, which have been at zero for 6 years now, you are just begging or laying the groundwork for a bubble or something to go awry with the financial markets, because when you keep interest rates at zero, it encourages risk-taking and speculation, and eventually you'll have somebody that will borrow too much, or you have the real danger of running into, let's say, an asset bubble, wherever that may be, whether it was in real estate or commodities or in tech stocks or maybe even now media stocks. So, you know, it took them over a year to get through taper. We announced taper in May of 2013. We began it in January of 2014, and we ended it in October. So outside the taper tantrum, I think they're trying to pave the way for the markets. And John, I think this is just going to be a slow grind that's going to take years. And if you look at the futures market, they don't see a normalization of interest rates where we get back up to maybe 3.5-4% on the 10-year treasury note. It may be 2017, 2018 before we get to that level. So before we get rates back up to normal, this is going to be nowhere like what Greenspan Fed did in 2004, where they virtually raised interest rates a quarter of a point at every FOMC meeting going into 2007. I don't think that's the way this is going to unfold going forward.
As my description of economic developments indicated, our economy has made important progress toward the objective of maximum employment, reflecting in part support from the highly accommodative stance of monetary policy in recent years. In light of the cumulative progress toward maximum employment and the substantial improvement in the outlook for labor market conditions, the stated objective of the committee's recent asset purchase program, the FOMC concluded that program at the end of October. Even so, the committee judges that a high degree of policy accommodation remains appropriate to foster further improvement in labor market conditions and to promote a return of inflation toward 2% over the medium term. Accordingly, the FOMC has continued to maintain the target range for the federal funds rate at 0 to 1/4%, and to keep the Federal Reserve's holdings of longer-term securities at their current elevated level to help maintain accommodative financial conditions. The FOMC is also providing forward guidance that offers information about our policy outlook and expectations for the future path of the federal funds rate. In that regard, the committee judged in December and January that it can be patient in beginning to raise the federal funds rate. This judgment reflects the fact that inflation continues to run well below the committee's 2% objective, and that room for sustainable improvements in labor market conditions still remains. The FOMC's assessment that it can be patient in beginning to normalize policy means that the committee considers it unlikely that economic conditions will warrant an increase in the target range for the federal funds rate for at least the next couple of FOMC meetings.
There you have Chairwoman Yellen saying that the policy will probably be accommodative for some time. And Jim, this would seem to back up your assessment that this rate cycle is going to be a long grind upwards. They're not in any hurry, because you know if they signal too much too fast, you know exactly how the markets are going to react.
Yeah, and I think there was something that really struck me in the testimony this week is, you know, the Fed has used sort of benchmarks. At one point, it was if the unemployment rate got below 6.5%, they threw that out the window. Then it became data dependent. But one new yardstick that struck me in this testimony is the new benchmark that the Fed threw out there is inflation is running well below the central bank's 2% target. So that may be the new benchmark to watch as to what the Fed does before it makes its first move. Now, if you look at what the Fed is doing or trying to do is, in my estimation, they're trying to give themselves a little bit of a wiggle room as to when it moves. What they want to do is get away from the target dates they did like with QE1. They said, okay, it's going to be X amount of dollars. It's going to end on June. Same thing with QE2. When they went to QE3, it was an amount, but they gave no definite time frame. And I think what they want to do here is give themselves some flexibility as to when they move. Now, if inflation begins to turn up, and the key indicator to watch here, folks, for that to happen is what happens with the rise in oil prices. If oil prices start to move, inflation starts to rise, obviously they could move sooner. So oil prices, at least right now, with falling oil prices, you know, when we're down below $50, that's given the Fed some leeway and has bought some time for the Fed to begin raising interest rates. So if you want to know where inflation is going, watch oil, John. I think that's going to be a key indicator to watch. And also what happens with inflation in terms of when the Fed makes its first move.
So what she's doing here is preparing the markets for the rate hikes that are coming. And the real question now is, will they begin at the March FOMC meeting?
You know, some, I would look for two things. And one thing that we're seeing, and they've emphasized this over and over, it's data dependent. And one of the reasons it's been data dependent is a good example, what we've been talking about here. On this Friday, we just got our second print on GDP in the fourth quarter. It's 2.2%. So we went from 4 and 5% growth rates in the economy in the second and third quarter of last year. Now we're down to 2%. So the growth rate in the economy in this recovery has not been consistent. And a lot of that has been due to Obamanomics and some of the things that are happening on the fiscal front. But right now, if you want to watch a turnaround in the LEIs, because right now they've been softening and rolling over. And we've talked about this on several of the programs over the last week. Also watch a second thing for a turnaround in oil prices. So a turnaround in the LEIs and a turnaround in oil. Now, a lot of that's going to need to happen if they're going to remove language at the March meeting, especially if they remove the word patient from the language that accompanies or is in the press release following the FOMC meeting. If they do move that they're going to remain patient from the press release in March, then that could indicate they may be moving in June. But if we see falling inflation, falling commodity prices, stronger dollar, weak oil prices, and also weakness not only in our own LEIs, but also LEIs overseas, then I just don't think they're going to move in June. It's probably more likely they're going to move in the third quarter, maybe as soon as September. So inflation and oil are the key things to watch here. I think that's going to drive what the Fed does next.
Well, you know, Jim, the last time the Fed alerted the markets to a change in policy, we got a taper tantrum. Bond yields almost doubled in 6 months. We got a 7% correction in the stock market. And the mortgage rates spiked, which slowed down housing growth. And housing is still lower. It's not as robust as it was before. So why a move now?
You know, I think what the Fed is going to do in try and finesse is, unlike when Bernanke first announced the taper, they want to keep a fallout in the markets from rate hikes. They don't want this to rattle the markets in the same way that the taper did when it was first announced in May of 2013. They are on the road to hiking interest rates. That's where they're going forward. What they're going to try and do is keep the markets from overreacting like they did in 2013 when you saw the 10-year Treasury note nearly double in 6 months. Instead, I think what they're going to try to finesse and get the markets to go long is how gradual this process is going to be. So get them away from focusing on, hey, when do you start raising rates? How much are you going to raise rates? They want the markets to focus, look, we're going to raise interest rates eventually, but they want the markets to say this isn't going to be a consecutive series of rate hikes. It's going to be a very gradual process. And that's what they're trying to sort of finesse in language and the things that they say and sort of coax the market into thinking, okay, look, we're going to start raising interest rates, but you guys don't need to worry about it. We're not going to kill the economy. We're not going to kill the financial markets because we know that's an important ingredient of what we're doing. What they don't want to do, John, is spend 6 years of quantitative easing, expanding their balance sheet by $4 trillion, and at the first signs of improvement in the economy, kill off the economy. They don't want to do that, so they have to be very careful here. And I think this is going to be a game of finesse. And, you know, we know the rates are coming. Whether they can finesse this is another story. They haven't been very good at it in the past.
However, one alternative measure that seems to fully capture a better sense of labor force participation is the U6 measure that lists total unemployed and underemployed at 11.3% as of January 2015. This measure has not dipped below 10% unemployment since before the crisis. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, there are now 12 million more Americans no longer participating in the workforce than January 2009. Do you agree that the unemployment number that you cited, 5.7%, in your opening statement, paints a rosy or a better picture of the true unemployment rate that I just cited?
So, Senator, it's the U6 is a broader measure of unemployment. It includes marginally attached and discouraged workers, and also an unusually large number of individuals who are working part-time who would like full-time jobs. So it is a much broader indicator of underemployment or unemployment in the U.S. economy. And while it's come down, it was 12.1%. A year ago, it's come down from there to 11.3. It definitely shows a less rosy picture than U3 or the 5.7% number.
Interchange between Janet Yellen and Senator Richard Shelby this week during hearings. He's a Republican from Alabama. And they're basically saying here that unemployment is not as rosy as the numbers imply. So unemployment is improving, but it's really not that great. The economy's slowing down. So how can they be that confident in raising rates and the effect it might have on jobs?
You know, John, I really don't think they are that confident, which is why they keep bringing up this point about being data dependent. I mean, they've got to be mindful of moving too soon, as they did in the past, finding themselves ending up reversing course. You know, think of Bernanke, Jackson Hole, 2010, when they were talking about exiting to finally talking about launching QE2. So everything is still data dependent. And we've seen that with Friday's numbers on GDP coming up with 2.2%. So they're going to be raising interest rates. But just as they have been kept low for 6 years, it's going to take a long, long time to normalize interest rates. So this is not going to be something that's going to happen in 6 months, a year. It's more likely to take place over a 2-3, if not a 4-year period before we get anywhere close to being normal. And by the time they do, I'm sure we will have another asset bubble, because when you keep interest rates this low, you're encouraging speculation, you're encouraging risk taking. And we know when you do that, people will take advantage of it. If you can borrow money at next to nothing, look what you can borrow money from Japan. Look what you can borrow money for in Europe. And think if you're a hedge fund or if you're leverage. So I want to emphasize, even though they're talking about raising interest rates here, it's going to be a slow slog upward before we get to anything close to normal interest rates.
So let's assume that you're right on this. Let's talk about the implications then for investors, because as I mentioned earlier on in the big picture today, you have to earn money and at the same time defend yourself from the changes that are underway. Last time they had this type of change, we saw a taper tantrum. We saw high single to double digit losses to bond investors. And now the question is, if we go through this again, are the effects going to be the same? Same thing or something different?
Considerable progress has been achieved in the recovery of the labor market. The room for further improvement remains. At the same time that the labor market situation has improved, domestic spending and production have been increasing at a solid rate. Real gross domestic product is now estimated to have increased at a 3.75% annual rate during the second half of last year.
So I guess the biggest thing is the word patient. Still, this is still the biggest thing, right?
The word patient has been both, they've used the word patient to help push further into the future the timing of when they will raise rates. At the December FOMC press conference, Janet Yellen talked about it would be a couple of meetings before, basically putting in summertime,
right,
when they would, you know, entertain raising rates. But the word, the patient word, has been kind of dogging them ever since then. A lot of Fed officials want it out of the statement in order to give them flexibility to respond to the data, because the Fed statement also says they'll be data dependent. They'll adjust policy along with how the economy performs. So what Yellen's trying to do is trying to find a way to get that word patient out.
You know, that was an assessment once again by the Wall Street Journal, John, and this again talks about the difficulty that the Fed finds itself. So as patience is removed, you've got the bank saying there, you know, things are going to start to tighten or restrict. And if credit conditions tighten, that only weakens global growth and also growth here in our own economy. But if you're going to see them move in that direction, you know, the one thing that investors need to do, bond investors need to be aware, because by the year end, we're more likely to see interest rates head higher. In fact, we're already starting to see some of that. If you take a look, it's already happened on the short-term end of the market. I mean, a two-year note has moved from 0.3% in March of last year. It's doubled. We're already at 0.63 on today's market. The three-year note has moved from, let's say, 0.645 last March. It's almost at 1%. And the five-year note has moved from 1.15 to 1.53 on this Friday. So we're already starting to see rates move up. Since spring of last year, they're already starting to move up on the short end, which is sort of flattening some of the yield curve, the long end of the curve being pushed down by foreign money coming into this country, buying U.S. debt because it's so much higher than what we're finding elsewhere.
Okay, so what should investors be doing then? I mean, we know that rates right now are at century lows. They're not going to be here forever. But if you're taking action, what kind of action is warranted?
Well, I mean, if you need income, let's say you're retired, you're having a pension plan, I strongly suggest what we've always done here on the program is you ladder your portfolio to protect your principal. If you're in bond funds, I'd gradually shift money out of those bond funds, or maybe you become a trader. But either way, we're at historical lows, which means rates are only going to be moving in one direction, which is up. And we're already seeing that, as I just mentioned, on the short end. So, you know, right now, I would say bond investors, beware.
So what we take away from all of this is the idea that the Fed is preparing the markets for coming rate hikes, but any rate hikes are likely to be gradual. The Fed's not in any hurry to raise or to do so aggressively. But if bond investors take notice, short-term rates have already risen, and the best days of a bond market may be behind us. So caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. You've already been warned, things, they are a-changing.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Turn and face the strain. Changes. Don't want to be a richer man. Changes. Turn and face the strain. Changes. It's going to have to be a different man.
And here's a reminder for all the Financial Sense NewsHour weekend listeners. If you're not a premium member, well, you should be. Here's a preview of one of the interviews coming up from next week.
For many Americans, Social Security plays a major part of their retirement plan. And especially in an environment with low interest rates, the decisions you make on Social Security could have a major impact on your retirement. Joining us from the Department of Social Security in San Diego is Yolanda York. And Yolanda, why don't we start out with some of the changes that went into effect for 2015 for our listeners?
Well, there's a couple of things that people really should be kept abreast. And I do want to highlight, you'll hear this information on the radio, but visiting our website, socialsecurity.gov, will give you all the new updates that we have, which is the cost of living 1.7. The Medicare premium remained the same at $104.40 for the Medicare Part B. But what is really new today, you know, there's going to be millions of taxpayers who will be gathering forms to do their federal and state local taxes. And Social Security always sends these individuals 1099 so they can do their taxes. But as of this month, individuals, if they misplaced it, lost their 1099 or never received it, they can go online to our socialsecurity.gov website and request the 1099 and have this information at your fingertips.
Well, that's good, especially as people get ready to file their tax return. Yolanda, let's talk about the base at which Social Security tax is assessed has gone up this year. What's that limit? I think it's $118,500. Would that be correct?
That's exactly right, yes. So after this, Social Security no longer taxes your FICA taxes. So the limit is at $118,500.
But you do pay Medicare tax, is that correct, above that amount?
Oh, yes. So the Medicare tax does continue to be unlimited, and those taxes do continue.
This week, the markets, both the S&P and the Dow, hit new records. What is grabbing the market's attention is the NASDAQ, less than 30 points away from 5,000. That's a number that was last seen on the NASDAQ 15 years ago. And the bears are saying it's a bubble, pointing to social
media. A bubble.
It's pointing to social media stocks. So now the question is, are the tech stocks back to bubble valuations? So the question is, do we break through 5,000? Then what? And then there's the price of Apple stock, $0.75 trillion. So, Jim, are we in another tech bubble? What thinkest thou?
Thou thinkest not a bubble, John. I mean, certainly you could say they're no longer cheap. But it's also not a bubble, and there's a big difference today between what was going on in March of 2000 when the NASDAQ reached the peak in March of that year. Here's a crazy figure. Back in March of 2000, believe it or not, the NASDAQ was trading at 100 times earnings. Absolutely insane. Today, we're probably closer to 21 times earnings. And look at it this way. I remember this, the last couple of years of the NASDAQ run-up. Last 3 or 4 years in the 90s, the NASDAQ was up almost 350% in 3 years. Think of where we are now. It's taken almost 15 years to regain that number. And if you look at the NASDAQ on an inflation-adjusted basis, we'd have to be closer to probably 7,000. So, John, it's not a bubble.
All right, then why the bearish argument in bubble? Of course, you know, it's the argument we hear every single year, as a matter of fact. We're supposedly in some kind of a bear market. But the second question that you really have to face is, why so long in a recovery?
Well, anytime you get a bubble in stocks, and that was certainly what we saw in 2000 when you had the NASDAQ selling at 100 times earnings, it takes time to recover. I mean, take a look at the real estate, which peaked in 2006. Here we are in 2015. Real estate prices are still down about 16 to 18%. From the peak reached in the last decade. And it was the same thing with the Dow and the S&P. The Dow and the S&P went nowhere for almost 13 years, and it wasn't until March and April 2013 that we finally exceeded the old highs reached back in 2000 and 2007. So what you usually have coming out of a bubble is you have PE multiples typically compress, which is what you see in a period of inflation, which is what we saw in the last decade. So it's been a combination of a number of things, John. It's been PE compression, a lot of that having to do with the inflation in the last decade.
All right, well, what about the Apple effect? I mean, the company's valued at close to $750 billion. How much of the NASDAQ is backed up by what we call the Apple effect?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at market cap in the NASDAQ, Apple accounts for probably 10% of the index value. But believe it or not, it still may be considered cheap. I know a lot of people are going to say at $750 million, but you look at the stock is selling at 15 times 2015 earnings and selling at almost 10 times enterprise value. Then here's the one that'll blow everybody's mind. Apple is sitting on $200 billion or nearly $200 billion in cash. I mean, Apple's cash balance is larger than some of the largest companies in the S&P 500. We're also about to see a launch of a new wave of products that are also going to increase the bottom line, increase sales, and also increase the company's enormous cash flow. There's only one other company in the world that is generating the kind of cash that Apple is generating, and that's ExxonMobil. And what that strong cash flow is enabling the company to do is increase dividends and also buy back their stock, which they're going to continue to do.
$30 a share, is that
right?
That's right. So one could argue that it's really a $100 stock.
That's right, and Jack makes a pretty good simple case, simple math. Remember, if it's going to make $10 per share in free cash flow this year, if you back out that net cash of 30 from, you know, around 130, 190, you get a $100 stock, you get a 10 times multiple on free cash flow. 10 times free cash flow is an amazingly cheap multiple compared to tons of stocks out.
That was a Wall Street Journal report echoing the idea that Apple is still cheap. But if it's not a bubble, then, Jim, how do we contrast the NASDAQ today versus where it was 15 years ago?
Well, the first thing that I would say is different today than, let's say, going back to where we were in 2000. You have real companies today. Back in 2000, John, it was the fiction of the new economy, which really wasn't based on reality. Many of the companies back then didn't even have earnings. In fact, some of them didn't even have sales. And you were using such silly metrics for evaluating a company like eyeball clicks. Can you imagine an analyst coming out today and talking about an IPO coming out in the tech sector and saying that, hey, they got so many eyeball clicks, that's just not going to fly. Today, the majority of the companies have real earnings and cash flow that support the valuations that you're seeing.
Right. Give us an example by what you mean, especially when it comes to valuations, as many bears are predicting some kind of a crash.
I mean, let's take probably a few examples of some of the most prominent companies in the NASDAQ. And these were the must go to stocks you had to own in the 90s. You know, think of companies like, let's say, Intel, Microsoft, Dell Computer, although that's gone private, or even companies like Cisco. I mean, some of these companies actually disappeared. Dell went private as computers really became a commodity and got replaced much by tablets and smartphones. Sun Micro, in that case, was bought out. Nonetheless, you take a look at these companies today, they have real earnings. Something else we haven't seen in 15 years with a technology company is actual dividends. And I want to take a couple of cases just to illustrate this point. Let's take a look at Intel, Microsoft, and Cisco. Two of those companies are Dow companies, one a NASDAQ company. I mean, Microsoft today has a dividend yield of 2.7%. The five-year growth rate of that dividend has been 18% a year. No wonder Bill Gates is the richest man in the world. Its P.E. multiple today is 17 times earnings. Back in 2000, it was selling at 57 times earnings. And today, Microsoft generates almost $25 billion of cash flow. They didn't even have anything close to that in earnings back in the year 2000. You move on to a company like Intel. Intel's dividend yield is almost 2.8% with a five-year growth rate of 10% a year. Intel's selling at 14 times earnings. Go back to the year 2000, Intel was selling at 43 times earnings. And Intel's free cash flow is $10 billion, almost 3-4 times more than what their earnings were back in 2000. And the real big, probably the most valuable company with the advent of the internet during the tech bubble was Cisco. Cisco today has a dividend yield of 2.6%. They just increased that dividend. Their three-year dividend growth rate has been 47%. They're selling at 14 times earnings versus the peak of the market in 2000. Cisco was selling at 127 times earnings. Their free cash flow was $8.9 billion. And finally, we've got to look at Apple. Apple's dividend today, not much, but, you know, it's 1.5%, growing at 10% a year. Apple's P.E. is 15 times earnings below the NASDAQ multiple and even the S&P multiple. And Apple's free cash flow is $33.3 billion a year. None of these companies, John, even came close to paying a dividend back in 2000, would have never even thought of paying a dividend back then. You just don't see earnings or P.E. multiples of 14 and 15 times and dividend yields of 2 to 3%. And you call that a bubble? I'm sorry, I just don't buy that.
Yeah, so there's a major contrast today versus 2000. I guess what we're saying here is it's more of reality today than a fiction of back in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, things are definitely different today. I mean, there's real substance behind these companies. Look what they've given us over the last 15 years. Everything from smartphones to tablets, now smart watches, home automation. Think of microchips. I mean, they're woven into everything we use, from appliances to our cars. And think of the internet has changed the way our commerce or the way the economy functions, although that may be slowed down with this latest FCC ruling on net neutrality. But we have more reality today than fiction, which is what we had back in 2000.
Okay, how do investors behave or think in this kind of an environment?
You know, I definitely have some technology stocks in the portfolio, and especially if you're, let's say, a dividend or risk-adverse investor. First of all, most tech companies have low leverage, have high returns on equity, buying back stock and increasing dividends, so they're very shareholder-friendly. So depending on what your objectives are, I think some technology in every portfolio is very appropriate.
Well, here we are at the end of February, looking right into March, and we know there will be the FOMC meeting. And I think the economic numbers, what do you think, Jim, are going to tell us a lot of what the Fed will be doing as we move forward from here. They're going to be watching those for indicators.
Yeah, I think a lot coming up in March, we'll have the unemployment numbers for the month of February. We're going to have a lot of LAIs. And I think that's going to be something close to watch, because if the second quarter or the first quarter of this year is looking anything like the fourth quarter of last year, in other words, we're tracking more at a 2% growth rate, I think the Fed's going to be somewhat hesitant to really move aggressively on the interest rate front and may postpone to later on in this year. So watch the economic numbers and watch the price of oil in terms of what the Fed may be doing when it comes to its March meeting. Those are things coming up in the weeks ahead. And also in the middle of March, we're going to get a preview of what first quarter earnings are going to be like. In the fourth quarter, a lot of companies gave some warnings and guidance about going forward. So we'll be watching what's going to happen on the earnings front. That'll be starting probably in the middle of next month. So those are the big things coming up ahead of us. The FOMC meeting, of course, coming, I think, what is it, the third week in March. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the shows. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.